walk in your ways. We bless your name. Amen. Amen. All right. I did have a little struggle getting the notes out this this weekend, and I apologize for that. So if you did not get the notes, please let us know in the chat box, and maybe someone can forward their notes to you if by chance you did not. But otherwise, let's get started. This week's Parsha, Baha Eloteka, when you set up. When you set up. And of course, the Parsha names are taken from the opening words of each portion's text. And that's where I thought we would focus today, is at the opening part of this Parsha in Numbers chapter 8. And I'm going to read a small part of that, and then I want to move right into an article. And I'm going to interrupt the article a couple times with some sidebar comments, one from the Midrash Rabbah, another one from the Apostolic Writings in the words of Paul. And then we're going to, at the end of the article, we're going to look at some additional words from the Apostolic Writings. So opening up with the text from Numbers chapter 8, beginning with verse 1. The Lord said to Moses, speak to Aaron and say to him, when you set up the lamps, see that all seven light up the area in front of the lampstand. Now, we won't focus a lot of time today on what that means, the area in front of the lampstand. But, and maybe I should have, it would have been helpful if I could have included a drawing in your notes here, but I want you to try to imagine where the front of the lampstand would be. So, and there's been some discussion among the sages over the centuries about what this means. But if you can imagine that the tabernacle, which eventually becomes the construction of the temple under Solomon, but in this context, we're looking at the tabernacle that was constructed, the sanctuary in the wilderness. So if we would imagine that we're, that the priesthood and the worshipers would enter from the eastern end of the sanctuary. And then you would see the altar, and beyond that, the beyond the altar, the laver, and then beyond the laver, the holy place. And then, of course, beyond the holy place, the most holy place. And, of course, we would know that in the most holy place was the Ark of the Covenant. But if we come back into, in our minds, as we're imagining this, into the holy place. So the holy place would be just beyond the laver and in before the veil that would separate the most holy place. So in this area as the holy place, we see the altar of incense, and we see the table of showbread, and we see the menorah, the lampstand. And so if we're entering from the east, that would put the Ark of the Covenant in the most holy place at the opposite end on the west, right? So I want to make sure you're kind of grasping the imagination here of what I'm describing. So we enter from the east, and then opposite of that would be the western side where the Ark of the Covenant would be, which, by the way, is why the wall in Jerusalem, the western wall, is such an important aspect, because it's the nearest place where you can stand and pray that gets as close as we possibly can to where the Ark of the Covenant would be in the temple. So I'm getting off track. Forgive me. So we enter from the east, opposite end where the Ark of the Covenant is the west. So in the holy place, that section of the sanctuary that's in between is where we have the altar of incense, the table of showbread, and the menorah. And the table of showbread would be on the right as you would enter, and that would place it on the north side. And then the south, which would be on the left-hand side. So actually, I think I gotta back up here. And make sure that I've got it opposite. see, this is why you should have a drawing in front of you, and so that you don't get your directions mixed up. But when you enter, the table of showbread is on your right, and that would be the southern end, and then the northern end would be on your left, which is where the menorah is. So the point that I'm leading up to, and I seem to be taking a long time getting there, is that in the passage when it says, see that all seven light up, because we know the menorah is made up of seven candlesticks, seven lamps, and served by a shamash or a servant candle in the midst of that. See that all seven light up in the area front of the lampstand. In other words, Moses and Israel were directed on how to construct the menorah, and it was constructed in such a way that the light would shine in the same direction from all seven lamps. And the way the lampstand was positioned in the sanctuary, the front of it would cause those lights to light up the area of the altar of incense and the table of showbread. So what was in front was across the width of the sanctuary. And that is as much of the point as I want to make right now. I'm just wanting us to kind of get a feel of the physical structure and layout of the sanctuary. Let me continue. Verse 3, Aaron did so. He set up the lamps so that they faced forward on the lampstand. There's the instruction where all the lamps are facing forward so that their light is projecting in the same direction, just as the Lord commanded Moses. This is how the lampstand was made. It was made of hammered gold from its base to its blossoms. The lampstand was made exactly like the pattern that the Lord had shown to Moses. So I want to go ahead and move right into this article. It's a fascinating article entitled Rush and Return, The Anatomy of a Flame. And the article is actually very, very old. We'll see if you look in your footnotes that the article was originally constructed by the Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi and Rabbi Dover of Lubavitch and the Lubavitchi Rebbe, all from around the latter part of the 18th century. Now, Rabbi Yankee Tauber has done some adaptations, and so he is a rabbi with Chabad and a Hasidic rabbi. And so he's taken the words of these other rabbis and considered sages, and he has made some adaptations so that we're able to read the article and understand its message. So let's look at the article. He comments, though it occupies only three verses in the beginning of our parsha, the mitzvah of lighting the menorah gives the whole of Behaloteka, when you raise light, its name. As detailed in the source text cited in our Parsha in-depth section, and what he's referencing there, and this would be a personal commentary from Rabbi Tauber, and if you have been on the Chabad website, each week they have an in-depth study of each week's Parsha, and that's what he's referencing, and I've given that link in the footnotes number 2 there. The lamps of the menorah are seen as representing the souls of Israel. And if you've sat through studies before of the sanctuary and how the sanctuary is built and laid out and all of the elements or the furniture pieces and the arrangement of those pieces in the sanctuary, you know that in different studies, they've come to represent things, right? And so in depending on the context and depending on the commentary, the elements of the sanctuary can come to represent a variety of things. And so this is essentially what this article is about. It is presenting an idea that among other things, among other messages that would be found, faithfully found in the sanctuary and what the sanctuary fully represents, among that is the idea that the lamp, the menorah, is seen as representing the souls of Israel. and the various laws governing the menorah's construction. And the lighting of its lamps are explained by the Hasidic masters as instructive of the nature and structure of the people of Israel. The manner in which the potential of the soul of man is to be ignited, the duties of the lamplighter, and numerous other insights into the spiritual art of lamplighting. Now think about that statement for a moment, because there's a lot there that's in that sentence. And there's a lot of, that we can kind of get lost in if we're not careful. But think about this, the numerous insights into the spiritual art of lamplighting. And I believe that that statement kind of capsulizes the study that we're having this afternoon. And the point that we're focusing in on is the spiritual art of lamplighting. And I'd like for you to just to kind of think about that for a moment and then kind of tuck it away, but don't tuck it away too far, because we want to pull that back in a moment. The spiritual art of lamplighting. He goes on, the foundation of the menorah, people lamp, soul equation, is King Solomon's declaration in the book of Proverbs, a lamp of God, the soul of man. And again, in the footnotes, I've included the complete verse of Proverbs 20:27 as it's been translated by the Jewish Publication Society. So if you look in the bottom of your notes for just a second, Solomon writes, the life breath of man is the lamp of the Lord, revealing all his innermost parts. Life breath. So where does mankind get its life, its life breath? It comes from the Creator, Hashem, when he formed us from the dust of the earth and he breathed into us. The breath of God is breathed into us and we became a living nephesh, a living soul. And so it's a Platonic idea, the idea of Plato that would suggest that mankind is made up of a tripart, body, soul, and spirit. And that's contrary to biblical truth. The biblical truth is we have an outer person and we have an inner person. And both have life and have movement. In him is our life and our movement, because of the life breath of God. And so Solomon says, the life breath of man is the lamp of the Lord, revealing all his inmost parts. And so when you think about it, where does our breath come from? Comes from our lungs, comes from our innermost self, right? And we can pull from the shallow part of ourself, which would be the upper part of our lungs. So when we're breathing from the upper part of our lungs, that's the shallow breathing. And that is the breathing we often go to when we're scared. And that's why when people are scared sometimes, or if they're feeling that they're feeling very stressed, that they might feel a little faint, a little lightheaded, because their breathing is shallow. But there is a place that you and I can breathe from that's very deeper than our lungs. And it's from our diaphragm. That's the part that's down here, oftentimes, sometimes called the kishkas, right? This is that deeper breathing. And in fact, they're part of our nervous system in our body. The vagal nervous system is directly connected to our diaphragm. So when we're under stress and we're scared, the diaphragm deflates. And if we can intentionally inflate our diaphragm, in other words, we would intentionally breathe from our very depth of our person, we can regain a sense of consciousness. We can regain a sense of control when we are in the midst of something that's very fearful or very stressful. So Solomon says the life breath of man is the lamp of the Lord, revealing all of his inmost parts. So we can imagine for a moment, because God does not have a physical body, so we're imagining some things. We're trying to refer to our bodies as a way of understanding what God has provided for us. And so if we imagine that the life that God breathed into us, that gave living life to our bodies and to our soul, comes from the very deeper part of God. And that very depth of God has been breathed into you and I. And we are now the life breath, the lamp of the Lord. Let me go on. The founder of Chabad, Hasidism, Rabbi Shneur Zalman of Liadi, delves into this metaphor, finding in the components of the physical lamp a detailed anatomy of the human soul. The following is based on Rabbi Shneur Zalman's analysis and subsequent discourses penned by the later Rebbes of Chabad. And before we go into that, I want to break away from the article for a moment to read something to you from the Midrash Rabbah. It reads, "To what may the matter be compared? To the case of a king who had a friend. The king said to him, 'I want you to know that I shall dine with you. Go then and make preparations for me.' His friend went and prepared a common couch, a common candelabra, and a common table. When the king arrived, there came with him ministers who encompassed him on this side and that, and a golden candlestick preceded him. His friend, seeing all this pomp, felt ashamed and put away all that he had prepared for him, as it was all common. Said the king to him, 'Did I not tell you that I would dine with you? Why did you not prepare anything for me?' His friend answered him, 'Seeing all the pomp that accompanied you, I felt ashamed and put away all that I had prepared for you, because they were common utensils.' 'By your life,' said the king to him, 'I shall set aside all the utensils that I brought, and for love of you, I shall use none but yours.' So in our case, the Holy One, blessed be he, is all light, as it says, the light dwells with him. Yet he said to Israel, 'Prepare for me a candelabra and lamps.'" What's the point of this midrash? The point of the midrash is, absolutely, when we compare ourselves to the king of the universe, we don't compare. Nothing we have that can equal or even come close to what he has. What we have, even the work of our hands, as creative as it might be, pales in comparison. But that is not the point. The point is that the Lord, Hashem, has invited us to prepare a table. He's invited us to be the servants in his sanctuary. He's invited us to be the light of the Lord to all the world. Isn't this what Yeshua said to his disciples? Isn't that the message that still resonates with us, even in the 21st century, that we are the light of the world? And so it isn't effective. It's insufficient for us to dwell on what appears to us as our insufficiencies. And that becomes a lot of people's excuses on why they don't hear and then obey. It's because they always see what they have to be less and ineffective compared to others. But we're missing the point when we do that. Because when we take what we have, whatever it is, to whatever capacities we possess, to whatever talents we have, and we allow the Lord to touch them, we allow the Lord to bless them, and then we're just faithful to go and do what we can do with what we have to do it with, then we accomplish God's purpose. Because this isn't about comparing ourselves to the Lord or comparing ourselves to one another. Allow me to move on. Back to the article. In this section, he calls the flame, the antipodal strivings. The flame surges upwards as if to tear free from the wick and lose itself in the great expanses of energy that gird the heavens. So you have to imagine now a light source, a matchstick, or maybe another lamp that's lighting the wick of the lamp. And the lamp has a container of oil. And so in that moment when the wick is lit, the flame wants to surge upwards. Thus the name of this parsha, when you raise the light, when you set up. So when you light that flame, it's close to the candle or to the base of the lamp, but as it takes on life, it rises. So that's the image he's painting here. The flame surges upwards as if to tear free from the wick and lose itself in the great expanses of energy that girds the heavens. But even as it strains upward, heavenward, it is already pulling back, tightening its grip on the wick and drinking thirstily of the oil in the lamp. Oil that sustains its continued existence as an individual flame. And it is this tension of conflicting energies, this vacillation from being to dissolution and back again, that produces light. And this is a vitally important point that is made here, the tension of conflicting energies. Now, I don't know about you, but in the world that I was born into and raised in was a Christian church world. And they tend to represent, and that was my understanding when I was growing up, that if you have enough faith, things will go well for you. And if things are not going well for you, it's because you didn't have enough faith or you didn't have strong enough faith. And I see some smiles and some nods here, and so do you. And so we've all are familiar with that idea, right? And yet, look at this message here from the Torah, that there is tension and conflicting energies. Wait a minute. I thought if I had faith in God, there would be no more conflict. What about that thing that people like to quote? You know, God is not the author of confusion. And so where does this idea of tension comes from? Where does conflicting energies comes from? This vacillation from being to dissolution. It's like two things fighting, right? Well, let's continue and see what we discover. The soul, too, yearns for transcendence, yearns to tear free of the entanglements of material life and achieve a self-nullifying reunion with its creator and source. At the same time, however, it is also driven by a will to be, a will to live a physical life and make its mark upon a physical world. In the lamp of God, that is man, these polar drives converge in a flame that illuminates its surroundings with a godly light. In other words, because there's tension, because the energies are conflicting, it creates light. That without the tension, without the conflict, there would not be light. Let's continue. He says, he now is going to shift and talk about the ingredients of the lamp. How is a flame generated and sustained? By means of a lamp consisting of oil, a wick, and a vessel containing them, so that the oil is fed through the wick to a burning flame. Oil and wick are both combustible substances, but neither could produce light on its own with the efficiency and stability of the lamp. The wick, if ignited, would flare briefly and then die, utterly consumed. As for the oil, one would find it extremely difficult to ignite it at all. But when wick and oil are brought together in the lamp, they produce a controlled and steady light. You get the picture. when the wick and the oil are joined together. And where are they joined? In the lamp. The lamp is where two very different elements and properties are brought together, oil and the wick. And together they produce a light, but not a light that's going to quickly burn out. It's a controlled and it's a steady light. The soul of man is a lamp of God whose purpose in life is to illuminate the world with divine light. God provided us with the fuel that generates his light, the Torah and its commandments, the mitzvot, which embody his wisdom and will convey, which embody his wisdom and will and convey his luminous truth. The divine oil requires a wick, a physical body, to channel its substance and convert it into an illuminating flame. The Torah is the divine wisdom, but for divine wisdom to be manifest in our world, there must be physical minds that study it and comprehend it, physical mouths that debate it and teach it, and physical media that publish it and disseminate it. The mitzvot are the divine will, but the divine will to be manifest in our world, there must be physical hands that actualize it and physical materials like animal hide for the tefillin, wool for the tzitzit, money for charity, with which it is actualized. And so much for, again, I referenced the world that I grew up in because, well, that's my story, right? That's the one that I have. And I wasn't blessed to grow up in a yeshiva. But I've been blessed to hang out with some people who have. It's good to see you, Lindy. And so in the world that I grew up in, you know, I grew up hearing people, you know, we would have what was called testimony services in our church services. And in the testimony services, it was often that people would say, you know, all I need is God. You know, I don't need anything else. I just need God. And, you know, and then we'd stand up and we'd sing a popular song. Jesus is the answer for the world today. Jesus is the answer for, never mind what the question was. We already had the answers, so we don't need to listen to the question. We've already got the answers. I don't know. I don't mean to be facetious, and I don't mean to be harsh or shaming of anything, but this is kind of a mindset that seems to be counterproductive and counter to what we're understanding from the Torah, because the point that the sages are communicating here is that the divine oil, and what is the divine oil? It's Torah, and it's the commandments of Torah, the mitzvot, but it requires a physical body. So that would suggest to me that God isn't enough. And that's kind of hard to say that, you know, there's just something inside of me that's screaming and saying, no, you can't say that. You can't say that. You know, it just feels really strange to say something like that. But the point being is that God did not create a universe without humanity. And when he did create humanity, he not only breathed into them, but he created humanity to bear his image and his likeness, the Selim and the Demut. And it is the humanity that carries his image and his likeness that carries forth the light, his light, as another rabbi put it, that we are vessels of the name of the Lord to be carried throughout the earth, not to huddle around towers like at Babel, but to go throughout the whole earth as vessels. And in this parsha, the vessel is the lamp. And in this lamp is the oil of Torah, and it is the wick of you, the wick of me, the wick of Israel, those of us who are walking in the ways of the Lord, who have been grafted into the commonwealth of Israel. That is the wick. And together, we create this light. There is this light. And just as the divine oil cannot produce light without material wick, neither can a wick without oil. A life without Torah and mitzvot However aflame with the desire to come close to God is incapable of sustaining its flame. And so we see that exemplified in a previous parsha when Aaron's two sons bring unauthorized fire into the sanctuary. Their desire was to be close to God, but they were not connected to the oil. They were not following the instructions that the Lord had given to them. And so their fire was incapable of a sustained flame, a sustained light, despite their passions. And how many times has that been true in things that we've observed in the world that we've walked in, right? Where people felt like, well, I'm passionate for the Lord. And somehow passion for the Lord was supposed to be sufficient. But then we watch those people quickly burn out and they're not able to sustain their life. They're not able to sustain a momentum and they sometimes give up in walking in the ways of the Lord. They become embittered in their heart and soul and they're filled with lots of questions that go unanswered for maybe years because they had the body, they had the good intentions, and they had the passion, but they had not yet connected with Torah. They had not begun to understand what Torah was about and the oil of the Lord. He goes on, to realize its role as a lamp of God, a human life must be a lamp that combines a physical existence, the wick, with the divine ideas and deeds of Torah, the oil. When the wick is saturated with oil and feeds its spiritual yearnings with a steady supply of the same, the resultant flame is both luminous and sustainable, preserving the existence and productivity of the wick and illuminating the corner of the world in which it has been placed. And now he shifts to talk about the colors, the hues of light. The flame itself is a multicolored affair, alluding to the many levels in which man relates to the Creator through his observance of mitzvot. Generally speaking, there is the lower and darker area of the flame, which adjoins the wick, its upper and brighter part. Now, the picture I've included was not a part of the article found on Kabbad. The picture was something that I found because I found it strikingly similar. So this is the mechanics of a light and the explanation from a scientific level, if you will, of the components of a flame. And so the base of the flame that's closest to the wick, sometimes called the blue zone, is the darker part. It's that dark part. And as the light rises, as the flame rises, it becomes so hot that the flame is invisible. And now it's not luminous. In other words, the part of the light that gives light, I should say the part of the flame that gives light, is that part that's closer to the wick. But as it ascends, it gets hotter and hotter. And he says the darker segment of the flame represents those aspects of a person's service of God, which are colored by their association with the physicality of the wick. That is, mitzvot, which are motivated by self-interest. The higher and purer part of the flame represents a person's moments of self-transcendence, deeds which a person does, as Maimonides writes, not for any reason in the world, not out of fear of evil or out of desire to obtain good. Rather, he does the truth because it's true. And so here we see another kind of description. As the flame ascends from the wick, we see that contrasting or conflicting energies. There's the part of the flame that desires to be seen, the desire to give off light, and that desire only happens the closer it's to the wick, closer to the physicality. But as we ascend for something higher, a transcendent existence, a deeper connection with the Creator, for as Maimonides says, simply because we're keeping Torah, simply because it is true and it is the thing to do and not for any other purpose. And so there's parts of us that we want to walk in God's ways because He is God. And then there are other times we want to walk in God's ways because we've actually discovered it's personally beneficial when I do. And it's beneficial for the people that I care about and who I live with in community. And so in one part of the world, they might say that one of those is better than the other. But this is why they're described as conflicting energies, because both are essential. And that is the struggle that we have, or what sometimes will feel like a struggle in our life, is that, well, as Paul once put it, there are things that I'm doing that I know I shouldn't be doing. But then there are other times I'm not doing certain things and I know I should be doing them. Oh, what a miserable man I am. It's that Yetzer Hara and Yetzer HaTov, perhaps, those conflicting energies. But it's not a matter of one being better than the other. It's the matter of in the conflict. This isn't about, the quest here is not to end the conflict or to rise above the conflict. The quest here is to find comfort and acceptance in the midst of the conflict, because it's in the conflicting of the energies that we're able to give off light. And so when you look at the history of Israel and the conflicting energies that they've experienced within the community of Israel and between Israel and other communities throughout their history, it is in the midst of those conflicts that Israel rises as the brightest light, the most sustaining flame. Other nations and other cultures have come and gone from Egyptian culture, Babylonian culture, Persian culture, Greek culture, Roman culture. They've come and gone. Even the Third Reich, who claimed to have the capacity for a 1,000-year reign, came and quickly gone. But what is the sustaining flame in the midst of exile, in the midst of persecution, in the midst of annihilation, in the midst of the Holocaust? The burning, sustaining light of Israel, God's people. Why would we not want to be aligned with them? Why would we not want to be joined with them? Why would we not want to be grafted in there? Both of these aspects of a person's life are reflected in his relationship with God. The mitzvot come not only to bind his altruistic, godly soul to the Almighty, but also to involve his ego-dominated animal soul in the fulfillment of the divine will. This is achieved when a person understands that he should love the Lord your God, for he is your life. By recognizing that God is the source and sustainer of his very being, the very same ego which earlier craved the most material of pleasures is now drawn to attach itself to the Almighty, out of the realization that there is no greater fulfillment of self possible. Then he gets to the point of Russian return. Thus the wick is both prison and liberator for the flame, both tether and the lifeline. It holds the soul in its distinctiveness from the divine whole, in its apartness from its creator. And yet in this distinctiveness and apartness, this incarnation in a physical life, which allows us to connect to God in the deepest and most meaningful way by fulfilling his will. Now, think about something that Paul writes about when he's in prison in the book of Philippians. Listen to Paul's words and see if this is not the very same thing we're talking about, this idea now that the wick is both a prison and it's a liberator. Paul writes, "For me to live is Messiah. To die is gain." There's the conflicting energy. There's the flame that Paul is burning. And on one hand, for me to live is about Messiah. To die is personal gain. If I am to go on living in the body, this will mean fruitful labor for me. Yet what shall I choose? I do not know. I am torn between the two. Have you ever felt that way? Torn between the extremes? I desire to depart and be with Messiah, which is better by far. But it is more necessary for you that I remain in the body. Convinced of this, I know that I will remain, and I will continue with all of you for your progress and joy in the faith, so that through my being with you again, your boasting in Messiah Yeshua will abound on account of me. Paul is working through his, because we all have a resistance to conflict. Nobody likes conflict. So when we start experiencing these conflicting energies, we feel like I'm torn between the two. I don't know which one to choose. Do I go to be with Messiah? Do I stay in the body? You know, back and forth, back and forth. And eventually, as Paul is working himself through this on an emotional level and perhaps a spiritual level, he finally comes to a very interesting point. He does not choose between the two. He accepts the existence of the two. He embraces the conflict. Because for Paul, he's going to live, but he's not going to be released from his prison to go visit and preach in the synagogues as he was. And yet he's not going to be able to die and go be with the Messiah. He can't die and go with the Messiah, and he can't be free, but he's going to keep on living. He's going to be in prison. He's going to be in prison for quite some time, and he's going to have to find another way to accomplish his purpose in that conflict. Back to the article. So when divine command, physical body, and human life come together as oil, wick, and lamp, the result is a flame, a relationship with God that is characterized by two conflicting drives, by a yearning to come close, coupled with a commitment to draw back. The materiality of life evokes in the soul a desire to tear free of it and fuse with the divine. But the closer the soul is drawn to God, all the more does it recognize that it can fulfill his will only as a distinct and physical being. So while the corporality of the wick triggers the flames to surge upward, the divine will implicit in the oil sustains its commitment to exist, to existence and life. Every mitzvah is oil for the soul. With every act that constitutes a fulfillment of the divine will, our lives are rendered into burning lamps, alight with flames that vacillate from heaven to earth, back again, and illuminate the world in the process. Therein lies the speciality of the mitzvah of kindling the lamps of the menorah and the holy temple. Every mitzvah generates light. Think about that. Let's not move too fast on that point. Every mitzvah generates light. Whether it involves giving a coin to charity, binding tefillin on our arms and heads, or eating matzah on Passover. But this mitzvah and the related mitzvot of kindling the Shabbat and Hanukkah lights not only transform us into metaphorical lamps, but also assume the actual form of a physical lamp. Physical oil, a physical wick, and a physical flame that produces physical, tactile light. Look, if you will, at some things that we can read in the apostolic writings. Yeshua says in Matthew, "Do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moths and vermin destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where moths and vermin do not destroy and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also." I highlighted that for this reason. Where your treasure is, there your heart is also. That's a phrase of directionality. Where the treasure or the things in life that we treasure, sets a trajectory or a direction for our life. And if our treasure is in the things of the Lord, if our treasure is found in Torah and in the mitzvot of Torah, that's where our heart will be. Our heart follows because that's the trajectory. And then he says, the eye is the lamp of the body. Now we know this is a Hebrew idiom, right? And so he's addressing the issue here of generosity as opposed to stinginess. The eye is the lamp of the body. If your eyes are healthy, your whole body will be full of what? Light. So a healthy eyes is a generous life. A generous life that freely gives. Just as it has freely received, it freely gives. And that's a life that's observing Torah. That's a life that's walking in the ways of the Lord. And so that life is full of light. How can it be full of light? Because we are the lamp. And that lamp is where the oil of Torah and the wick of our physical body, keeping Torah, observing Torah, come together. And so the idea is that enlightens us, that our eyes are made bright. But that is about being generous. In contrast, but if your eyes are unhealthy, your whole body will be full of darkness. If then the light within you is dark, how great is that darkness? He says in Matthew 25, at that time, the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. Five of them were foolish. Five were wise. The foolish ones took their lamps, but did not take any oil with them. Think about what we've been talking about and what the oil represents. What distinguishes the foolishness from the wisdom? Foolish is leaving with your lamps, but not taking oil, as if you think that the lamps can burn without oil. The wise ones, however, took oil in jars, not just the oil in the lamp itself, but they brought reserves. The bridegroom was a long time in coming, and they all became drowsy and fell asleep. At midnight, the cry rang out, "Here's the bridegroom, come out to meet him." Then all the virgins woke up, trimmed their lamps. What does it mean to trim your lamp? You're trimming off the burnt part of the wick. The foolish ones said to the wise, "Give us some of your oil, our lamps are going out." "No," they replied, "there may not be enough for both us and you. Instead, go to those who sell oil and buy some for yourselves." But while they were on their way to buy oil, the bridegroom arrived. The virgins who were ready went in with him to the wedding banquet, and the door was shut. Later, the others also came. "Lord, Lord," they said, "open the door for us." But he replied, "Truly, I tell you, I don't know you. Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know the hour, the day, or the hour." The idea here is that I may live in community with people who are Torah observant, but if I'm not Torah observant, their observance of Torah does not benefit me. It does not keep my lamp burning. Each person is responsible for the revelation that the Lord has brought to them. I cannot count on the revelation of my mother, my father, my grandmother, my grandfather. I can't even count on the revelation of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. I can benefit from those revelations if I'm choosing to walk in the revelation that the Lord has brought to me. But if I'm choosing not to be obedient, if I'm choosing not to observe, Yeshua says that if you love me, you will keep my commandments. The only way we really get to know the Lord and the Lord gets to know us is when we walk in his ways. So the consequence of not walking in his ways is not being known. Does that make sense? He says in Luke 35, "Be dressed, ready for service, and keep your lamps burning, like servants waiting for their master to return from a wedding banquet, so that when he comes and knocks, they can immediately open the door for him." In Mark 4:21, he said to them, "Do you bring in a lamp to put it under a bowl or a bed? Instead, don't you put it on its stand? For whatever is hidden is meant to be disclosed, and whatever is concealed is meant to be brought out into the open. If anyone has ears to hear, let him hear." Consider carefully what you hear, he continued. With the measure you use, it will be measured to you and even more. Whoever has will be given more. Think about what we just read in the parable of the 10 virgins, 5 wise, 5 not wise. Whoever has will be given more. Whoever does not have, even what they have will be taken from them. Walking in the ways of the Lord is how we keep the light burning. Then a mighty angel, this is from Revelation 18:21, and we'll conclude with this. Then a mighty angel picked up a boulder the size of a large millstone and threw it into the sea and said, "With such violence, the great city of Babylon will be thrown down, never to be found again. The light of a lamp will never shine in you again. The voice of bridegroom and bride," there's that reference to bridegroom and bride again in relationship to light. "The voice of bridegroom and bride will never be heard in you again. Your merchants were in the world's, your merchants were the world's important people, but your magic spell, all the nations were led astray by that magic spell." Awesome words from the Lord for those who for generations have worked against the Lord, against the Torah, and against God's people. But for those who will walk in the ways of the Lord, for those who will join themselves, grafted into the Commonwealth of Israel, and begin to walk in the ways of the Lord of Torah and keeping mitzvot, they will tap into that oil, and the wick that they bring to that oil will be a sustaining flame. And together, we become an even brighter light for the world, for all the nations to come, so that every tongue truly will confess that Hashem is King of the universe. Amen. All right, that'll conclude the lesson. I'm going to unmute everyone. It's great that we can do that. And you're open to make comments, ask questions. Again, it's really good to see all of you.
Is there somebody talking?
You are.
Oh, I thought I heard something. I'm just saying hi.
Hi, Lindy.
Very good.
Hi.
It was good. I was following along with the notes, and also in there's a book that maybe you guys might be interested in. It's called The Midrash Says. So it's got a lot of what you're saying. So there's a lot of, you can't study this without commentary. You can't study it without it. So
can you hold the book up one more time for everyone to get another peek?
It's a set.
The Midrash Says. And who's the publisher?
Who's the publisher?
Art Scroll.
Art Scroll, yeah.
You Art can, Scroll.
You
okay.
Have it? There's
Thanks
five
for sharing that.
Books. There's 5 books, one per book.
Okay.
Good. You can get it online, I think. Just go and look at The Midrash Says and you want.
Yeah. All right. Thank you for sharing.
I'm listening to preaching. It's almost over.
You're sober?
It's almost over.
Have a stronger.
5 minutes.
All right. Anyone else have a comment or question?
No. The hatchback doesn't open.
Hi, Melody.
Hi, Lindy.
How you doing?
I'm doing well. Good to see you.
It's good to see you too. Hi, Abid. Hi.
Hi. Hi, everybody.
How are you? Hey,
fine,
it's nice
fine.
To see everybody. I don't get on Saturdays very often, but it's good.
It's good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you. Well,
anyway,
I have a comment.
Yes.
I have a comment about it, and it's really interesting how this fight, you know, of our Diaz, Ken came up with a light, you know, because if you see our lives, you mean, even when we go to eat, now we apply all these ideas about the Torah, right? From the moment that I have my plate, you know, with my family, and I can start to say, well, and I am thinking in my job and all that, I can say, well, I'm gonna breathe, and I'm not supposed to think in my job anymore. So now I am gonna share with my family and start to enjoying this meal, right? And then we focus in the plate and says, well, what is gonna be the praying that I'm gonna do, right? I'm gonna eat vegetables, or I'm gonna eat some fruits. So every single, what I like about the Torah is that every single time I have to make questions to myself. And that conflict between my ideas is what brings light, right? Because my understanding is, getting higher, right? So I remember the last year when I studied this passage that I read that the lamb is like a representation of our faces, right? Three arms, the three right arms represents our right eye, our right ear, in one of the holes of our nose, and the other three the same, right? But the candle of the center, it represents our minds, in it represents the mind and the soul of the man. So, and now that you make this study, it makes a lot of sense, right? How we bring light to ourselves, to our family, and to the people that is near to us with the revelation that God gave us. It was really interesting. Thank you for the study today.
Well, thank you, Avid, for sharing those comments and that point of view. It's fascinating the different midrashim that come forth and the way the different ways of looking at the Torah text and to bring it alive for us. And it's always fascinating the depths that opens up for us, not just for an intellectual or a cognitive understanding, but how that now will translate into our obedience. In other words, when the Sabbath ends and the new week comes, how differently will I live my life? How much more will I walk in the revelation of the Lord and accomplishing His purpose? How much more will I faithfully carry as a vessel the name of the Lord in all of the places that I go? So thank you for that comment, David.
Roderick, I had a question.
Yes, Charlene.
You had mentioned, you said about in the midst of the conflicting energy we give off light. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Sure. So the conflict of energy that I was trying to describe and that was referenced in the article is the conflict that we experience where there's a part of us that wants to care for us. We want to care for our body. So we are intentional about getting good sleeps, and we eat the right kinds of food so we're properly nourished and we have some activity in our life. And we practice maybe mindfulness so that we're caring for ourselves. We take a bath and we wear good clothes and we put on lotions because we care about ourselves and we care to present the best version of ourselves when we're in connection with other people. So that's on one side of this conflicting energy. You see, there's no sin in that. There's no sin in caring for yourself. There's no sin in getting good sleeps or eating right foods or taking a bath or going out and purchasing something new because something that you had is old or worn out and you want to replace it with something new. You're caring for yourself. You're caring for your world. You know, it's even things that are mundane, like running a vacuum cleaner because you don't want dirt on your carpet. So, or using a broom to sweep off the leaves from your walkway on your porch. All of those things are things that we do, and that's the part that's closer to the wick. That's the physicality, right? On the other end of this spectrum is the desire to live beyond those things, and that we don't want to be held captive by things that seem at times to be trivial, like sweeping the front porch or running a vacuum cleaner or taking a bath. That we want to live a transcendent life. We want a life that has a higher meaning, a higher purpose. We want to get close to the Creator. We want to be all that He's wanted us to be. And so there's this pursuit that there's this pursuit for God. And sometimes in order to have that pursuit towards the Lord, we find that there, we want to get rid of things in our life. We want to divest ourselves of some of those things that have been kind of trappings. But the close, and this is the point that the authors of this article was making, is that the closer we get to the Lord Himself, the more we're pulled back to the physicality of the world, because to accomplish His purpose, mm-hmm. we have to be physical. Mm. Does that make sense?
Hello.
It does. Yeah, it does.
Hello.
Yes. Who's speaking?
Viola.
Viola, welcome. Yeah. It's good to hear from you.
Thank you. I didn't get to hear the whole sermon because I was running errand for someone else. But what about the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer Tov? It's their... They're fighting against each other?
At times, the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer HaTov can appear and can feel like they're opposing one another. But in fact, both are essential for us being the person who the Creator made us to be. And they are essential for accomplishing His purpose on the earth and in and through our lives. And so we have this, again, there it's a very similar conflicting energy as I was attempting to describe. The Yetzer HaTov, that good inclination, is in pursuit of the higher ideals, the transcendent ideals that we come to understand about God, God's character, and what it means to be in His presence. But on the other end of that is this Yetzer Hara, this... And it gets called, it's translated as an evil inclination, but I think that that translation does a disservice because of how in the Western world we define the word evil. And so if we see it only as an evil inclination versus a righteous or good inclination, then that's very easy to see this as a conflict between good and evil. And that's not what this is about. It's not what I've come to understand about the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer HaTov. Lindy, did you have a comment?
No, finish.
Oh, and so there is a wonderful book that I read, and I've read it a couple times now, The Lonely Man of Faith. And in the book of The Lonely Man of Faith, he talks about the two Adams, the Adam from Genesis chapter 1 versus the Adam that we find described in Genesis chapter 2. And in a lot of ways, the author of the book, The Lonely Man of Faith, comes to understand these two Adams, which are essentially the same person. They're not two different people, but they're two dimensions or two aspects of the same person, are very much reflective of the conversation we're having right now. And so in this Parsha and in this article, in this Midrash, is the idea that it's in the conflicting of the energies that light is produced. In other words, if all we did was draw close to the Lord and we divorced ourselves, if that was even possible, it isn't, but if we were able to divorce ourselves from all physicality and only live a transcendent life, we would be so close to God that our light would be invisible and it would not be luminous. In other words, we would be so heavenly minded, we would have no earthly good. The other side of that, if we are so focused on being an earthly good, but we're devoid of connection with Torah, connection with the Lord, and now we're just doing it our way, we become like the commentary in the book of Judges. Each man did what was right in his own eyes. Neither of those extremes work well to accomplish God's purpose. If you want to say it this way, balance is achieved in the extremes. And so in any given moment in life, for those who are endeavoring to walk in the ways of the Lord and accomplish his purpose, in any given moment in our lives, we're going to feel the strain or the tension of that pull. There's going to be one force pulling us towards the Lord and another force pulling us towards the earth. And it's not about overcoming that tension and living above it. It's about living in the midst of that tension and realizing God is helping us to live in the pulls of the two extremes. And it's in that tension, in the midst of the two, that we're able to accomplish his purpose. Balance is never static. It's always dynamic. In other words, you never get the weights to be perfectly still. Because if you achieve that, then you're dead. Life is in movement, not in the not moving. And so as long as it's like this, so the question is, and I don't know, I'm going to attempt something since we're on camera and we can see each other. I'm going to attempt something. I'm going to back up here for a moment to where you can see more of my body. So if what we want to achieve in sense of balance is both feet planted on the ground, right? Because if I got both feet planted on the ground, I can be balanced. But life isn't like that. Life is sometimes we're standing on this leg because we're going in that direction. And then sometimes we're on this leg, we're on this direction. And we're balancing all the time on one leg between the tension pulls of the two extremes. So how does any person have a balanced, stable life when you're living on one leg? You learn how to dance. And the Torah gives us a rhythm for dance. Work 6 days, rest seventh. Work 6 days, rest seven. And periodically in that rhythm, you're going to take another break for the feast of Passover, Shavuot, Tabernacles. Every 7 years, you're going to have another shift, but there's a rhythm that Torah presents. It's hard to understand because in the Western world, a world that is devoid of Torah, has ignored Torah and minimized Torah, they've substituted the rhythm of God's word with another rhythm. And anytime you have a substitute, that's idolatry. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yes.
That was excellent, Roderick. Thank you.
That was beautiful.
Yeah, that was...
Torah is learning a new dance.
Yeah.
And I learned a long time ago that for those of us who were not raised in Torah, but now we are, it feels awkward because you're learning a new dance. And so sometimes I find that I'm dancing, even though the music doesn't make any sense. But if I keep dancing, little by little, the music begins to make sense because it becomes more familiar.
Without the Yetzer Hara, you will have no drive. And you need that in order to have a drive to accomplish whatever it is that we need to accomplish. But if you only use that, you've lost.
Yeah. Those are very true words. Absolutely. And I have lived those words where I had the drive, I had the passion, and I ran out of gas. Yeah. Well, any other comments or questions?
Nope.
No, well done.
Thank you for being a part of the study today, and may the Lord bless you. So for you who are still in the time zone of Sabbath, Shabbat Shalom. And for those of you who are about to enter into the week, or maybe already have, Shavuot Tov.
Thank you.
Many blessings.
Not quite, but close. Getting Charlene, close. you're in New Jersey or New York? Yeah, I'm in New York. Yeah. Okay.
Good weather.
Let me know if you ever come into the city.
I sure will.
Okay.
All right. I'm going to sign off.
All right, y'all.
Many blessings.
Shabbat
Shalom. Bye, guys.
Shabbat Shalom.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
Excellent.
Bye. Bye, Addie. How are you?
Bye.
Bye. Say hi to everybody for me.